Hello and welcome to the final episode of Series 1 of the VoiceOver Talks podcast. My name is Scott Tunnix, a voiceover artist from the UK and creator of the VoiceOver Talks podcast series. Now, normally at the beginning of each episode, I take some time to introduce my guest for the week, but considering this week's guest is quite literally the most well-known voice in the country and is famous for introducing others with his trademark roar, I don't think I have the nerve to even try to introduce him myself, so I think I'll just leave it to him. Peter, take it away.
Yes, this week on the VoiceOver Talks podcast, it's me, Peter Dixon! Was that okay?
Peter, that was absolutely incredible. Thank you so much. That was brilliant. I feel so honored just to have you on the show here with me today. So thank you so much for taking the time out to come and talk to me. Have you ever had to introduce yourself in your own trademark style before?
Yes, I have. Once I did, I don't do it very often, but I sometimes am called upon to act as a stage host at big events. And on one particular event, the host who was booked to come and be the InVision host couldn't make it. And so I was co-opted to not only be the voice of God, but also the live host. And it so happened that I had this little introduction, which I'd done on one of my pen drives. I gave it to the sound guy, and it sort of starts like this. I say, with big dramatic music, "You've heard him on your radio. You've seen him on your telebox. Now it's time to meet him in person. Will you please welcome..." And then there's a big pause there at that point. I go, "Me!" It's really my alter ego, Scott. I'm not really as completely megalomaniacal.
Do you know what? I don't imagine that you walk around the house in that voice every day, you know, answering the phone like that. And as I said, you have the most well-known voice on British television. You've voiced over 250 documentaries, over 100 TV shows. You've worked on over 30 AAA games, and you've voiced in excess of 30,000 radio and TV commercials. Just wow. I mean, that alone just blows my mind. And of course, many are voiced in large batches, but if you voiced just one TV or radio advert every single day for a year, it would take you almost 87 years to reach that number. That's just mind-blowing.
No wonder I feel knackered. I have done a lot, and for that I'm, of course, very grateful. It's been a great career to have had, and I'm still enjoying it. And I've done more or less everything that you can do in voiceover, even voice my own memoir, my audiobook, which was the only thing I'd not done up till last year, was record an audiobook. And I'd not done it for various reasons, because it's very long form, it takes a long time. And it's not for the faint-hearted. Not that I'm not faint-hearted, but I just didn't have the time to commit to doing something as long as that. But my own book, which I wrote, I wasn't going to give that to anybody else to read, so I had to do it myself. And that was an interesting experience, Scott. It was very, very long. I mean, if somebody said to me once, "What's it like to read an audiobook?" And I said, "Well, go into the smallest room in your house, usually the downstairs bog, sit in there for 5 hours a day for a week, reading out loud to yourself with a single light bulb for company, and you'll know why." That'll give you a good idea of what it's like to read an audiobook.
I think that's probably enough to put almost anyone off of the idea.
I don't know why they all want to do them. I don't know why. It's one of life's mysteries to me.
Well, we'll come on to that a little bit later on, because it is an absolutely fantastic read. But just going right back to the very beginning then, you were born in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and you started your career in media as a BBC journalist in your teens. And if I'm not mistaken, I think you currently hold the record for being the youngest ever BBC television news presenter at the age of 17.
Yes.
Which is pretty incredible.
I think that's right. I think it's still the record. I don't know. I don't check these things, but I think it's probably unlikely to have been beaten, particularly now given the health and safety and all that stuff that goes on around human resources.
So that might just be a record that you hold for the rest of time then, I think.
I think probably it will be. I mean, it's the impetuousness of youth, isn't it? It's the brass neck of a young 17-year-old who thinks that he could walk into Broadcasting House in Belfast and ask for a job which is what I more or less did. I mean, I would never dream of doing anything like that now. You wouldn't get away with it. You wouldn't get past the front door. So I did. And that's what happened. I was still in school. I mean, I laugh about it now, but I was virtually just out of short trousers. And I walk in and get this part-time job, which bridged the gap between school and university, and then carried on while I was at university. I was doing a degree in psychology. I did 4 years at Queen's University in Belfast, and during the, in between lectures and weekends and things, I was going into Broadcasting House to do various presenting work and announcing work, news reading, and those sort of things between the ages of 17 and 22, I think it was. Then I joined the BBC full time as a radio announcer, and the rest is history. I then answered an advert in the BBC's internal magazine in Belfast, and it was for a 6 months attachment as a Radio 2 presentation announcer in London, which was where I'd always wanted to end up. And so this was a golden opportunity for me to do that. Answered the ad, went across, and spent 10 glorious years working with some of the country's greatest radio broadcasters ever. You know, people like Terry Wogan and Kenny Everett and those sorts of people who really influenced me, and I learned a great deal from them.
Yeah, what a fantastic way to start. Now, I would say that you could probably write a book in response to this next question, which of course you have. but from your roots with the BBC and in radio, how did you first discover voiceover, and how did your voiceover career start and really take off?
Well, that's interesting. There wasn't such a thing as voiceover, really, when I started. It was just beginning, I think, although most actors who were worth their salt, or who, you know, considered themselves to be classically trained in that way, they eschewed voiceover greatly. They thought that was beneath them. Doing a voice on a TV or a radio commercial was not the sort of thing that they should be doing. So there was a sort of, in the 70s, I guess, a band of a few people who were doing voiceovers and making a very good living out of it, because there weren't very many who were doing it. And then in the 80s, when I came to London, I got chatting to a guy called Ray Moore, who was a fantastic broadcaster in his own right. He did the early show on Radio 2. And, you know, when he finished his Radio 2 job, he'd go off and go home, sort himself out, and then go out and do some freelance voice work. He worked as a promo announcer on BBC television, and he also did a lot of corporate voiceover work, which I talked to him about. And that was fascinating to me, that this kind of world existed, because it was largely hidden. And so I looked into the world of voiceover, and it was revealed to me that there were indeed the opportunities for us to make money doing business-to-business presentations and corporate work. And so that's what I started to do. And that was really my first kind of foothold into the freelance world, which I didn't fully enter until about 9 years after that, because I was sort of still working for the BBC. And then I was then working on Steve Wright's show, which was where I discovered my love of character voice work, doing character voices on his show. And so those two things came together, the character voices and the corporate work, and I was getting more and more demands to do things, and I couldn't do them because I was working for the BBC. So you get to this point where you think, well, I either jump ship now, or I never jump ship and I become a BBC.
Yes,
kind of, I become a pensioner with the BBC. So I didn't want that to happen. I'd been there 10 years. I wasn't learning enough, and I was, well, not that I wasn't learning enough. I'd learned, I was repeating myself. I wasn't learning anything new. And so I thought, well, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. So I did jump ship and never looked back.
It's a scary moment, isn't it, when you take that leap from going from some form of secure or paid employment to becoming solely a freelancer in any field.
Absolutely. Have you done it yourself?
I did, yes. I did it back in 2020, last year. So I only discovered the world of voiceover in 2018. And by 2019, I was able to drop down to part-time in my corporate job. Mm. And the following year, I was able to drop down again. I was only doing 2 or 3 days a week then in my corporate job. I was at the point then when I wasn't able to give myself 100% to my day job, and I wasn't able to commit 100% to voiceover. So both areas of my work life weren't getting the attention that they needed. And so I made a decision at that point to pursue what I absolutely loved doing, made the transition to full-time freelance voiceover. And again, I've not looked back. It's been the best move that I've ever made.
Yes, yes. Well, it's not easy. I mean, it requires a lot of hard work and self-discipline
to sort of get up
in the morning and do what you have to do. But if you get those things right, then, you know, you're right. It's the best job in the world, isn't it?
Absolutely. And if you love what you do, you never work another day in your life.
True. That's true.
Peter, what was your first wow moment or, you know, the breakthrough job that always stands out in your mind as the moment where you thought, this is what I was meant to do?
Well, it must be, I mean, going back to those early days when I walked into the reception of Broadcasting House in Belfast, it has to be my very first professional broadcast, which was the most unremarkable 10 minutes of my life ever, I think, in terms of its impact. But for me, it was groundbreaking. My first broadcast was at 6 o'clock in the morning on BBC Radio Ulster, reading the farming fat stock prices.
Oh, wow. definitely a memorable.
To a bunch of ruddy-cheeked, fat-fingered farmers around Northern Ireland. And maybe only about 20 people listened to it, but it might have been cheaper to put it onto a cassette and send it to them in a jiffy bag. But I think it was, to me, I left the BBC that morning walking on a cloud. I thought, I've actually broadcast on Her Majesty's BBC Airwaves. They've actually let me loose. And I couldn't believe it. So that was a real standout moment for me, your very first. It's like anything first time, you know, whether you're flying a plane, and I've done that, but your first solo flight, your first solo broadcast is something that's quite remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. My very first broadcast, I say broadcast, it was one of these Sky channels, you know, channel 907 that no one's ever going to watch. And it was for some legal company, and it was a TV commercial. And it was the first ever TV commercial that I'd done. And this was way back when I had first started. And so I wasn't sure exactly how these things worked. And I wanted to make sure that I was paid first. So I sent across a watermark version, and it was actually my partner's voice. I got it just to say the words audio watermark. And I put that on a loop very faintly in the background. And obviously, it was a very low-budget channel because by mistake, and this is after they'd paid me and they'd received the non-watermarked file, they actually aired the version that had my partner in the background going, audio, watermark, very faintly.
I hope they paid her as well.
Well, she loves it. It's her claim to fame. So that was my very first piece that went on air, my first television broadcast. So not quite as sentimental to me as I was sort of overshadowed by my partner getting in on it. But of course, just one of the things that, one of the many things that you were known for is being the voice of the X Factor. And I think at its peak, there were almost 20 million people tuning in each week. So how did that come about? And what was it like working on a show for such a long period of time that became as big as it did?
Yeah, well, it's a monster of a show, absolute behemoth. And it started out when I was working on a show called Test the Nation with Anne Robinson and Philip Schofield 17 or 18 years ago for the BBC. And the sound supervisor on that show, a guy called Robert Edwards, who's a good friend of mine, went on to work on a show with the working title The X Factor. Nobody had heard of it. And he rang me up one day and he said, they're looking for a voiceover to do this new show. I don't know whether you'd be interested in it. It's called The X Factor, and it's one of Simon Cowell's vehicles. I knew Simon from way back before then anyway. And I said, yeah, well, can they send me a copy of the pilot and I'll have a look at it? So this thing arrived in my inbox. I had a look at it. And I knew instantly this was a sort of show I could really add value to. I really wanted to be involved in it. It was a big, brash pantomime of a show. Certainly much different in the early days to the way it ended up because of literally the amount of money they chucked at it. But I knew then that it could be something really big. But though nobody, not even I, knew how big it would get.
Yeah.
And so I auditioned for it along with a few other people. And within a few days, they told me that I'd got the job, which was brilliant. And, you know, it's 16 years it was on air for. Every autumn it came around and its announcement signaled the beginning of the winter season. It became an appointment to view for millions of people, as you rightly say. You know, 20 million people would watch the show. And then it franchised itself all around the world like some kind of benign virus.
Yes.
It went everywhere. And every single, even the show I did, went to many countries, many English-speaking countries. And then, of course, there were the non-English-speaking countries that adopted the format and then created their own versions of the show. which just goes to show you how popular it was. And I think at one point it was the most popular show ever in the history of television, and was eclipsed a few years back by the Got Talent brand, again owned by Cal. That became the most popular show ever on television, and I think still holds the title. So, I mean, from my point of view, it was a great shop window. It was a fun show to be involved in. I loved every second of it. And, you know, I think it's come off air now, obviously. I think that was the right decision. And whether it comes back, I don't know. I'll be the last person to know, Scott.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question. Do you think the show will make a comeback at some point?
I don't know. I really don't know. It may well come back, but it won't be tomorrow, but it may well come back. Who knows?
Well, watch this space. As you said earlier, having started out before the term voiceover artist was even really a thing, I imagine most, or if not all, of your work prior to the late 2000s was based in external studios. So just discounting the effects of the pandemic for a moment, what sort of percentage of your work these days is based in an external studio versus your home studio?
Oh, I'd say 10% external, 90% here in my home studio.
Wow.
It's literally, wow. That's the pandemic, of course. I mean, the larger projects that I'm involved in, the video games, and the larger, more well-funded agency-produced commercials for TV would be done principally in London, in the big audio production studios that I frequent, but... And some of the promo work would be done in London, although more of it is now done from remote studios like mine here. So it's changed the landscape considerably. I think that the pandemic has hastened what was going to happen anyway, in that the pandemic forced us apart, and the technology was always there. Well, not always, but in the last 5 years, it's been there to enable us to work remotely. But many people didn't want to work remotely. They didn't quite trust it. And of course, the large production studios have always had a vested interest in not having us work remotely, because they have expensive sound booths and microphones, and they like to charge people to use them. So they've always tried to, I've always noticed that they've always tried to pick holes in my audio quality, or anybody's audio quality. Doesn't sound quite as good as that. Can you just do this? They're always trying, in front of the client as well, they're always trying to argue with you about your studio sound. You know, and I know my sound is as good as theirs. My booth is many instances, it's better.
Yeah.
And because I work from my own home studio, I know how to create the sound and make it good, and I'm relaxed in here. I work here all the time. So in many ways, they get a better result from me working remotely than they would where I was in a studio.
Yeah, of course, you've not got that travel time as well.
The travel time is gone now, largely, which is, you know, is great. It's the expense and the time, of course, to get somewhere. The downside, if there is a downside, I think it probably is quite a valid argument, is that you don't get to see so many people. You don't have that whites of your eyes in interaction with people that you that I liked to have. But there's a happy balance. I think if I could go to London 2 days a week, I'd be quite happy with that. But anymore, I wouldn't want to commute every day.
Yeah.
That would be, it just grinds you down eventually.
And do you see this as a permanent step change in terms of home recording sessions, or do you think the balance will start to restore over the coming months and years as things return to normal?
No, I think it's a permanent shift. And it will definitely, and has already started to have a negative impact on the professional larger sound studios in London. Some of them have had to shut their doors, sadly.
Wow.
I still think that the larger budgeted projects will be carried out in the bigger studios in towns, but the middle, and increasingly so, the sort of upper middle work will be done remotely. And certainly all of the sort of bread and butter lower telephone stuff and what will be done from people's home studios, certainly. I think it has changed a lot. And will continue to change as people invest more in their home studios, as voice actors become more proficient, as engineers as well. I think it's going to become much more prevalent as we move forward.
Now, talking about your voice specifically, your Irish accent is all but gone these days, although I know you're able to slip right back into it when needed. Can you give us a little taste of that Northern Irish charm?
I certainly can. And I was watching Taken the other day with Liam Neeson, just laughing out loud. He never changes his accent at all.
No, he doesn't.
Even when he's pretending to be an American, he still has that voice there. I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want, but what I do know is I have a particular set of skills that make me a nightmare for people like you.
Peter, that's incredible.
I can go back there. And of course, in Northern Ireland, it's a wonderful country because it's got so many accents within that small country.
Yes.
Only a few counties, you know, but it is actually, there's a diversity of dialect within Northern Ireland, which is remarkable, from east and west of the Ban and North Antrim and down into County Down. It's, yeah, they're very specific, rather like Scotland, I guess, and Wales.
And to a lot of outsiders, it probably all sounds very similar, but when you know all of these separate dialects and you've lived there for a part of your life, it's very easy to sort of distinguish between
them. Yes. I mean, where Neeson comes from, he comes from the north of Northern Ireland, so County Antrim, Ballymena direction. And Ballymena, they talk like that there, a very rural accent. And that's where a lot of people come from, well, went from Ballymena, they went across to America during the famine. And that's why a lot of people in the Appalachian Mountains, they talk like that. That's a bit like Ballymena, isn't it? When you come back to Ballymena and you go to American accent, they're talking like that. That's the same kind of thing. And that's where that comes from, Scott. God damn it, man. That's right. Yes, that's right, boy. That's no problem at all. God love you now. Oh, aye, no problem. Oh, no.
Oh,
don't be saying.
Goodness me. Peter Dixon, that is incredible. Does it feel natural to you, or do you have to really think about it now in terms of that transition back to your Irish roots?
I wouldn't have to think about it. I can switch into it, but I wouldn't choose to, even when I go back there. I mean, I suppose if I was there for a month or two, I would slip back into it again a lot more. But it's like muscle memory, you know. When you start, when you're a professional speaker, when you're a voice actor, a voiceover, most of my work requires me to speak with a, or at least it did then, maybe not so much now, but then back in the 80s, 90s and early 2000s, you had to speak with a fairly neutral British accent, and that what used to be called received pronunciation, but it's no longer acceptable. I think people, and I'm glad they do, they embrace the diversity of these islands and the how we sound, and that's why you hear so many lovely regional accents on TV and radio now, which is a great thing.
Now, normally, I like to ask my guests what's one thing you wish you'd known when you began your career, but for someone who's made it quite literally to the very top of the industry, maybe it's better to ask, if you were looking back at your career, would you have done anything differently?
Just about everything, probably. I wrote a little blog once about the, don't be frightened of the F word. And by that, I mean failure. And for years and years, I used to think, oh, I've failed again. Oh, this is awful. I've made a mess of this. I've gone down the wrong route. And, or I should have done that, should have done this. And, you know, if you look back over anybody's career, particularly successful people, you'll find that they've actually probably failed more than most. And so I failed an awful lot because I thought I could reinvent the wheel all the time. I thought I knew better. I could always do it my way. And of course, there is, of course, the only way to do things, which is the right way. And so all you've got to do, really, if you want to be successful, is just copy other people. And I don't mean copy their style. I mean just copy their modus operandi, the way they work, and ask questions of them. If you've somebody you particularly admire, ask them how to do things. You'll find that most people are quite happy to talk to you about these things, and that's largely the reason why Hugh Edwards and I started Gravy for the Brain, because between us we had 60-70 years worth of experience in radio, television and film, both in front of the camera and mic and behind it. And so we'd started the company basically to pass on that combined knowledge to those who were coming behind. That's been probably one of the most fulfilling and things I'm most proud of the things I've done. So that's why I continue to do it, and that's why he does as well.
And it's an incredible resource. And for anyone who doesn't know, it's a complete online voiceover career training platform. And, you know, it's one of the things I cannot recommend it enough as a one-stop shop for literally all things voiceover. And I think there's currently an offer running, isn't there, where you can sign up for the reduced rate of £29 a month?
Or that's right,
about $40 US at the moment. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, you can.
So for anyone listening,
gravyforthebrain.com.
Absolutely. as I've said, you have the most, or one of the most well-known voices on British television and radio. And I know in your book, Voiceover Man, you mention a few times that you're not a big fan of the spotlight and, you know, you much prefer to be behind the microphone. But does your face ever get recognised in public? And when people find out who you are, what's the one voice or line that you're always asked to say?
Yeah, as you rightly say, I mean, I do touch on this in the book. You know, one of the attractions of being a voice actor is that you are not physically, visually known. Although I have done telly, I've done bits here and there, but not enough to really register with the public because you have to be on TV a lot. I mean, on an almost daily basis to be recognised. I mean, I've done character parts on, you know, Harry Enfield shows. And I was the voice and face for a number of years of E4, the Channel 4 youth channel.
Yes.
And did loads of stuff. And occasionally you'll find people will recognise you, but very, very rarely. But when they do know what I do, and sometimes I'll be at a dinner, for instance, and somebody will say, what do you do? And I say, I'm a voice actor. And they used to look blankly at you and say, well, what's that? And nowadays they seem to know what a voice actor is. So I tell them what I do. And they say, well, what, would you have done anything that I may have known? And I said, well, have you got about 2 weeks I can show you my IMDb profile? So I just tell them a few of the highlights, and as soon as I get to the X Factor, their eyes light up and they say, oh my God, is that you? And I said, yes, I'm sorry about that. And then the next thing they want me to do is to shout their name in their ear, which I'm very happy to do for a fee. No, I'm only joking. I always say that though. Yeah, I always say that, and I said, I always shout their name in their ear, and I turn around and face them and I said, that'll be £10. And they look at me as if I'm serious. I do that. There are lots of names that I love saying. I mean, every year on The X Factor, I used to relish the email coming in telling me who the 12 finalists were. I'd scan the list for the most interesting names, usually the ones with the most unpronounceable surnames or the ones with the most syllables. And there's always one people always want me to say, and it's Rachel Adadeji. And I say that a lot, even in my vocal warm-up.
I read a story that you actually gave, I think it was Joe McKeldry, the wrong name, or you sort of changed his name.
I did, yes, I did.
Inadvertently.
I did, and I got his name in the usual way. They don't tell me, and I never meet the people, but they send me the names, and I record them, and I send them back. And I looked at Joe's name, Joe McKeldry, and I read it as Joe McKeldry. And it went on air. He sang his songs, the whole series. He went through to the final. I met him and his family in the after show party. And his father came up to me and he said, are you the voice of the X Factor? I said, yes, I am. Very nice to meet you. And he said, well, I just want to tell you, you've changed my family's name. I said, what do you mean? He said, our name's McElderry and you've called us McKeldry. And I said, well, why didn't Joe say something? He said, well, he didn't like to. He didn't feel it was his place. So now he's known as Joe McKeldry, bless him. Yeah, he's actually all right about it now.
It's amazing that that's stuck as well. And he's sort of just gone with that and taken it with him. Amazing. I've seen a few videos now of the comedian Joe Lycett, and some of them where you guys are both together in the video, and
oh, yes.
He does a pretty incredible impression of you. It's really quite impressive.
He does. And you know, we did discuss at one point him actually doing a whole X Factor show, coming to my studio and recording the lines and not telling anybody.
Do you know what? I think you could probably do it. I think you probably could. But the amazing thing is he sounds so different to you in a normal speaking
yes.
voice. Moving on to Voiceover Man, the extraordinary story of a professional voice actor. Tell us a bit about the book and how it came about and what anyone who hasn't yet read it can expect.
Right. Well, the book has been a long time in the making, I have to say, probably about 15 years. And I started it and then something else came up and I stopped and I lost the appetite for it. And then I wrote some more notes and then I started another little bit. And this went on, as I say, for about 12, 15 years. And the reason I started writing it was because many of my friends and colleagues had said, you know, over dinner parties and drinks and things, I'd regale them with stories of the shows I've worked on and the many famous people I've worked alongside. And so they said, oh, you've got to write a book about it. You've got to get this down in a book. And I did agree with them. I said, I have to do a book, but I just couldn't find the time or the inclination to finish it. And then when lockdown one happened last year, in March, and we were all locked down, so couldn't go anywhere, I thought, right, if I'm not going to do it now, I'm never going to do it. So I sat down and I finished it. It took a long time to write, and even longer to proofread and design. My son, Connor, who's a professional graphic designer, he helped me and did a fantastic job on the cover and on the inside design. There's lots of little quirky things in there that audiophiles will love, you know, little graphical instances of volume meters and knobs and buttons and things like that. It's really, really, really cool. One of the little touches, I mean, you can't see this obviously, but on the book, the bottom right hand corner of every page is the page number, and above the number is a little dial that when you flick the pages like this, the dial moves around. Unless you know it's there, you will never find that.
Yeah, well, now you know.
There's a little touch like that you might discover one day and think, ooh, somebody's done something there that we didn't even know about. So there's lots of things like that in the book.
And of course, your story and your journey to the top of the voiceover world is incredible. But for me, the book also gave me an amazing insight into, you know, the history of British broadcasting and how it's evolved over the last 40 to 50 years. It really is quite incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so fortunate to have played a part in that, a small part, very small part. But I was at the centre of British broadcasting at the BBC for what I still consider to be one of the last few years of its golden era before the wrecking ball came in and it all became very corporate. When I was there, it still had remnants of the old civil service about it, and chaps who ran departments were ex-Navy types who smoked pipes and wore blazers and disappeared off to the golf course after lunch and never came back. and there was a BBC club across the road, which was very nice, and nobody batted an eyelid if you had a glass of wine or a beer at lunchtime. Those were the days when you were treated as adults and you had to just get on with it. And if you didn't do your work, you lost your job, provided the work was done and done to a sufficient quality, which it very often was. There were some brilliant people working there when I was there, who, even though they had a glass or two, could still get the work done and do, you know, produce the most amazing programs. So it was a fun time. Very, very fun.
That's Voiceover Man, the extraordinary story of a professional voice actor. And that's available via Audible. You can buy a physical copy on Amazon and
any bookshop. Anybody, you can get it
a
anywhere.
A physical bookshop, Pete.
It couldn't be more available. But I would order it on Amazon because it's on special offer at the moment. It's a temporarily reduced price. So if you want to buy it, now would be a pretty good time.
Excellent, excellent. And I will put any links in the show notes, which will be available at voiceovertalks.com. Moving on to my next question, Pete. Do you have any really embarrassing moments in your voiceover career? I know your book is filled with some...
It's full of embarrassing moments.
Absolutely. But is there a single standout embarrassing moment for you?
Yes, I think there were several. I'm trying to think of one that would be broadcastable. We're not even on the air, so it's fine.
Too much to reference. I think when your career spans almost 43 years, I think these sorts of moments are pretty much unavoidable, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one in the book that makes everybody laugh is the one... I was doing a show called Cirque de Celebrité, which was a big sort of circus, in actual physical circus tent in London. Anyway, we were there. The idea of the show was that various celebrities would come and join and they'd do various circus skills. And they'd put me in this little sound booth outside the tent made of corrugated iron and cardboard and bits of wood hammered together, and it wasn't particularly glamorous. In fact, it wasn't glamorous at all. It wasn't even waterproof. One particular show, just before we went on air, the wonderful director said to me, "We've got a few changes here," so he kept me back, and I normally would go, before the show starts, go to the loo. I didn't have the opportunity to do that this time, and I'd just consumed a tin of Coke, so I was now feeling a little bit under pressure, shall we say. The show started and I couldn't contain myself any longer. So I suddenly thought I had this cracking idea. I would actually use the Coke tin as a receptacle, which I managed to do with some difficulty. But it was pretty much a stroke of genius on my part. I thought it was great. And it solved the problem. So until the ad break, when I thought, I'm going to have to dispose of this. So I took the Coke tin out of my little sound booth, trudged through the mud, hopped over the guide ropes of the tent, and out of one of the flaps popped the host of the show. And she said to me, "Oh, God, it's so hot in there." I said, "Is it?" And she said, "Here, give us a swig of your Coke." I shall spare her blushes by not naming her, but she is named in the book. Anyway, so she lunged forward to me in my direction. To my absolute horror, her perfectly manicured hand reached out and was about to grab my Coke tin. And I just thought, if she gets the hand hold of this, I can't be responsible for anything that happens next. I just thought she'd probably feel the warmth of it through its thin aluminium skin. So I thought, no, I actually said, no, you don't want to drink that, love. No, it's gone off. And she looked at me. She said, what do you mean it's gone off? It's Coke. It doesn't go off. I said, no, it just tastes wrong. And I scampered off to the Portaloo and disposed of it. I thought if she had got a hold of that and swigged that, she'd have chucked it all up all over her Diamante dress. And this was a live show. Could you imagine? So that was one of the very disappointing moments. And there were others. There was another one involving the lovely late Bruce Forsyth, which was the cheese incident in a hotel room in Leeds. But you can have to read the book because it's quite a long story.
We won't give everything away here, but there are some absolutely incredible stories. But as I said, when you've been doing this for as long as you have, these sorts of things are absolutely unavoidable, but they do make for some very entertaining stories.
Yes, they do indeed.
Sort of on the flip side then, Peter, what's the hardest thing about working as a voiceover artist?
Well, I think the uncertainty of it all, and every day you wake up, you're unemployed, basically, unless you've got a booking from the day before. But most of our work comes in on the day, as you know, maybe a few days in advance. But by and large, it's the terrifying roller coaster of a ride that you go on when you're freelance, because you can sometimes get fallow periods. Everybody gets them. The trick is not to panic too much, but keep doing what you do, keep your marketing going, and keep contacting people, and start finding work for yourself. Don't always rely on your agent to do it, because they invariably won't. So it can be quite hairy at times, but the thing is to look at your income over, say, a year, and at the end of that year you will have earned X. And if X is better than what Y was when you were in employment as an employee, then you're doing okay. But of course, during that year, you'll have weeks where the phone won't ring, literally, and you'll wonder, what the hell have I done? But you have to just trust in the annual figure. And if at the end of the year that figure X is less than Y, maybe you're in the wrong job. Or maybe you're at the start of your career and you're building that platform for yourself. And so that's one of the things that's the most difficult for a lot of people to get around.
Something that a lot of voiceovers are worrying about themselves at the moment in terms of their own futures. What is your view on the advancement of AI voices and how they're starting to make their way into the industry? For instance, Voice123, one of the pay-to-play sites, now asks clients when they're posting a job if they would like to also receive auditions from Voice123's own AI voices too. So already we're seeing work being taken away, or at least an attempt to take the work away from real voices. So what's your take on AI voices?
Well, the completely computer-generated voices are hopeless. They sound terrible, and they will never, ever replace the nuance of the human voice in certain applications. And by certain applications, I mean, the higher-end work of movies, documentary narration, audiobook reading, that sort of thing. But with the more advanced AI voices, of course, those are generated from real voices. So real actors, real voices will go into a studio and read for weeks, and it will find all those little bits from the various files, put them together in milliseconds, and create what sounds like an approximation of a human voice. It's still not quite there yet. I've heard some very good ones, but the question is, who owns the copyright at that point? And my worry is, deep concern, is that if I was to lend my voice to an AI engine, you could literally have me say anything political, something that might be against my own political views, or something of an adult nature, say, that I may not say publicly or want to be heard saying publicly, you get into the whole fake news issue. So these are dangerous areas that need to be carefully regulated, and I haven't seen any evidence of that yet, although I think that's coming, and it has to be there. There has to be some sort of process where if somebody wanted to use my voice, for instance, they could, and I wouldn't have to physically read it, but I could license my AI voice, but I would have to have final approval on what was created by the engine. So in other words, the client doesn't have access to unfettered freedom to do whatever they want. They can say, we want Peter to read this script. Here's the script. Send it in. The engine creates it. It's sent to me. I approve it. And they get the actual finished file back. That sort of process would be acceptable to the majority of voice actors, I think, because they wouldn't have to do the work. they'd have to do a lot of work initially, and then sit back and license their material to clients. So I think it's not going to take our work away completely. It's certainly going to take away some of the lower medium level work that we do currently, telephone systems, explainer videos, that kind of thing, where human nuance is not necessarily needed. But the higher end work, the big budget television commercials, cinema commercials, video games, that sort of thing, it's always going to be done by human actors.
And a lot of the time, it's just easier, isn't it? I mean, you could have an AI voice that is able to do a range of different emotions and things like that. But, I mean, there comes a point where it's quicker to have an actor in the studio and tell them how you want the line delivered rather than trying to get AI to read a line and then having to go through that process of adjusting the pitch here and adjusting the intonation there and making so many changes to get that exactly as you want, when you could have an actor just read the line how you want it the first time.
Exactly. I think you're absolutely right. As I say, these AI engines are great for if you've got a telephone system, some interactive voice response system on you're a business and you want to change something quickly and you're not too worried about whether the voice sounds like this, then you can do that in seconds using the app. So not an issue. But as I say, for projects where human nuance is required, I think it's still a long way off.
It's really interesting to hear your take on it as well, having been in the industry for as long as you have, which leads on to my next question, which is what excites you about the future of the industry? Sort of the opposite to the worries that we're getting about these AI voices. Is there anything that really sort of gets you excited about where the industry is going?
Not really, no. I'm kind of worried about the drive down, the tendency, the race to the bottom on rates. That worries me because, I welcome people into the industry. I think that the industry benefits from the diversity of voices that are now working in it. And there are many more people doing it. In fact, there are something like 1 to 1.5 million voice actors around the world globally now.
Wow.
It's a $5 billion industry. The biggest sectors are animation. Tons of that being made right around the world. After that would be corporate, internet explainer kind of work. TV and radio ads, audiobooks and e-learning. So there's lots of sectors, but because there's more people in the business and a lot of people who don't know what they're doing, and many of them aren't getting hired, by the way, of those million people, they're not all actively working every day. The problem is that they come into the industry, they drive down the rates. And that's part of the reason why Gravy for the Brain exists globally, with its rate guides to educate not just the voice actors, but also the hirers as to what is an acceptable level of remuneration for what we do.
Yeah.
And it's not kind of protectionism. It's not keeping the rates high. I think the rates are fair because, after all, we have to be available. We haven't got second jobs. We have to sit here with and maintain and power up studios and buy expensive computers to work and microphones and what have you. And we have to be available. So we have to be remunerated. And people say, what, you get £200 for an hour's work or half an hour's work? Yes, but that may be the only half hour work that you do that day or week, So you have to be aware that some of us do very well. Some of us are very, very, very busy and do extremely well. But those are in the minority. The majority of those 1.5 million people around the world are probably earning very little. So drive to the race to the bottom, driving down rates is an issue that concerns me. I think we've got to educate clients. And it's something that Voice 123, for instance, were very keen to do, to incorporate our rate guide into their system. So hirers know exactly what to expect now.
And it's always a fantastic resource to be able to point clients to when clients come in and either offer you a low rate or ask you about what rates they should pay, because there are a lot of new clients in other areas that are producing content that requires voices, and so having that as a reference point is a really useful resource to have. Is the Gravy for the Brain rate card?
Yes, exactly. It gives you kind of some sort of legitimacy.
Yes, absolutely. Peter, what advice do you have for anyone who may be interested in or who has dabbled in voiceover in the past, but is really looking to take their next step into voiceover?
Don't. I'm being flippant but serious at the same time. It's not something for dabbling in. You have to, of course, you can join Gravy for the Brain. That is, as you mentioned at the very beginning, a great resource. And even though I run it with Hugh and it's our team of people, we've got a lot of people now working with us. It is a great resource. And if you want to learn about voiceover for very little money, you can join us for a month or for as long as you like. There's no kind of minimum term. You will learn and you'll be able to ask questions and join the forums and find out as much as you can before you make the leap. And of course, you can make a leap part-time while you carry on your day job. And I always say to people, never give up your day job until at least you've done a year of this, where you're confident that you're earning enough money to support yourself and your family. But it's not a get-rich-quick scheme. And this is what people think it is. They think, oh, it's easy money.
Yes.
I can read, I can speak, everybody can do that. So I can do this in front of a microphone and earn squillions. Of course, it's not the way it is. And it's if you're looking for an easy way to earn money, then don't look at voiceover. It's not an easy way at all. It's one of the most difficult things you could ever do. So don't jump into it thinking it's going to be an answer to your prayers. It's not like having a cash machine. It's not. It can be very nice when you start earning from it, but by God, it's not an easy thing to do. So my advice is, ask plenty of questions, join Gravy for the Brain, get some training, go and speak to some tutoring or mentoring in real life situations, and practice. You don't have to spend a lot of money initially on equipment. You can, if anybody's got a computer, that'll do. You can download Audacity. That's a piece of free recording software you can record yourself on. You can even do it initially through the microphone that's built into your laptop. Not that you'd ever be hired to provide sound through your laptop, but just to give you an idea of how you sound, that's a great way to start. And then when you get more confident, you can buy a USB microphone maybe to dip your toe a little further into the pool. And then when you start earning some money, you can maybe spend your first paycheck on a nice microphone and an interface. And then you're in a position to start recording, and then you have to look at your recording environment. You know, I always sort of say you need to have a space in your house where you can have peace and quiet, and also attenuation on your walls so that you can, sound like you're in a professional studio, even though you may be in your closet surrounded by T-shirts and trousers.
That's some amazing advice there from the king of voiceover himself. So thank you for that, Peter. And in addition to everything that Gravy for the Brain has to offer, you also do one-on-one coaching sessions too. I've had the pleasure of coaching directly with you, and I cannot state just how useful those one-to-one sessions are. I mean, you gave me exactly what I wanted or what I needed in terms of just brutally honest feedback. You really gave it to me straight, which is absolutely essential if you want to learn and progress. How can people listening get in touch with you if this is something that they are interested in doing with you?
Well, it's only something that I offer through the platform. So, I don't do this outside of that. Otherwise, I'd be doing it all the time. If you are interested in becoming a voiceover or getting some one-to-one, certainly join Gravy for the Brain. It's £29 with the offer up front. And from there, you can access the experts on the forums. And if you want a one-to-one session with any of them, including myself, you can do that and book it on the website itself.
Fantastic. And as I mentioned earlier, I'll put all of the information and links in the show notes, which will be available at voiceovertalks.com. And just finally then, the last question that I like to ask all my guests is about goals that they set themselves for the coming year, but voiceover goals. But for a man who has quite literally done it all, what's next for you? Do you have any goals that you can share with us?
I don't, and I never have had, actually, oddly enough. I never had a plan.
Maybe that's the secret.
I don't know. I mean, I'm divided on that. I think you need to have some kind of goals, but I guess it's because I never had one. I kind of just drifted into it and I worked hard. My God, I worked hard at it. I did it long hours. And in the days when we had to go to studios, I drove all over the country. And, I was doing a radio show in London at the time, the breakfast show. So I was on air at 6 a.m., up at 4 a.m., in at 6 a.m., finished, came off air at 10. And then I drive from London to Newcastle and do do some radio commercials and then drive back to London and go to bed and get up again at 4 a.m. I mean, that was very hard work, very, very, very long hours. So I put myself out and about a lot. So partly that was the reason that those opportunities presented themselves to me, I guess, just simply by meeting so many people and getting to know people. So my only advice to you would be expand your network, get let people, as many people as you know what you do for a living, and just, you know, keep reaching out to people and trying to help them. So what can I do for you, not what can you do for me? So I think that's the way I've approached it. I never had a plan. And as for ambitions, I don't really have any left. My ambition now, I suppose, if I have one, is to grow Gravy for the Brain into a world-leading platform, or more of a world-leading platform than it is now. And that would be my legacy. That would be great. I've done the book. That was another one I've ticked off the list. So I think probably that's it. I mean, I've done more or less all there is to do. I don't think there's anything left that I haven't done. I might go and do something completely different. Who knows?
Well, Peter, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come and speak with me today. It's been absolutely incredible and no doubt has provided so much value to the listeners and a real insight into the single most well-known voiceover artist in the country. So, Peter, thank you so, so much.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. It's been great fun. And hasn't time flown by? Look at this. We've been here an hour.
I know, it does. I know, and I'm so grateful for the hour that you've given me, Peter, so thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. What an incredible insight into the life of a true voiceover legend, the wonderful Peter Dixon. You can find out more about Peter at peterdixon.com, or you can follow him on Twitter at Peter Dixon. And that's it for Series 1 of the VoiceOver Talks podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and if you are listening for the first time today, be sure to check out all of the previous episodes available at voiceovertalks.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like to stay up to date with information on Series 2 or even get involved with the series, you can join the VoiceOver Talks Facebook group, or you can contact me directly via scott@tunixvo.com. And I'll see you soon.